The Tom Woods Show, episode 1712.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody, tell me if this sounds like you. You're debating healthcare with your interventionist friends, and you just can't seem to hold your own. They immediately claim the moral high ground, and you just don't know how to respond. Well, check out my free ebook, Your Facebook Friends Are Wrong About Healthcare, and you will be shocked. Yes, even you, a veteran libertarian, will be shocked at just how solid the libertarian position is. Pick it up for free at yourfriendsarewrong.com. Hey, everybody, Tom Woods here. Alex Epstein is back with us again. You'll remember Alex as the author of The Moral Case for Fossil Fuels. He's also the founder of the Center for Industrial Progress. And today we're going to talk about his new project, EnergyTalkingPoints.com, which can help both the lay reader and the political office seeker. Alex, welcome back.
Hey, Tom. Good to be back.
Let's run through some of the points at EnergyTalkingPoints.com. I'm glad to have you back, by the way. I've had you on to discuss some of the biggest issues facing us today. We talked about the virus and the state response to it. I don't know that we expected that in August it would still be like this. And how much of the public would have gone along with it. That's a separate conversation.
Yeah, we could easily get into that. I mean, just one sentence on that is, I think that so much of the issue is that the government is still on the premise that its literal goal is to minimize deaths from this particular virus. And so that's such a corrupt conception of what the government is supposed to do. And so you just see this mass destruction of every aspect of life, and still that's an ideal. And even some of the critics of the government are still on that premise. They're just saying, oh, it's not that big a deal, versus saying, no, there's something very wrong about a government that does this. So, okay, let's move on to energy. I don't want to get too much
into that. I know. So we could spend all day on that. But given that it is an election year, you know, there are a lot of topics that get discussed. The virus is very much front and center. But here we have Kamala Harris now being named as Joe Biden's running mate, and she's being portrayed as a moderate, and he's made a safe choice by picking a moderate. But she supported the Green New Deal of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. This is not really a moderate position. So energy policy is still important here. What did you think about that choice, by the way?
Well, the thing is, so in terms of the Green New Deal, and then fracking has come up in particular, and I tweeted about this today, because she has explicitly endorsed a ban on fracking. It's not like Joe Biden is any kind of advocate of energy freedom or even kind of moderate energy statism. He's not very clear on what he advocates, but at different times, he's basically said, I want to ban all fracking. And if you look at his energy plan, that's one of the sets of talking points I have at energytalkingpoints.com, he's basically saying we need a carbon-free grid in the next couple decades. And that basically means outlawing fossil fuel use. And if you just think, okay, fossil fuel use is over 80% of the world's energy use, about 80% of the US's energy use. And they're literally saying, hey, let's outlaw that. And they don't even really support nuclear. I mean, this is, if you want to talk about something radical, it's hard to have anything more radical than just totally abolishing the only way that we know of producing low-cost, reliable energy for a whole bunch of people.
Well, one of the points in your list of talking points, or rather one of the topics covered, is Joe Biden's energy plan. Now, as you're kind of suggesting that it's not super clear exactly what he wants. But the thing is, that's sort of Joe Biden himself. I don't think he's somebody who has really strongly felt ideological beliefs. I think he goes with the flow. That's been true his whole career. So I don't know that he's ideologically committed to the kind of destruction that some other people are. I think maybe he'll say things that he thinks people want to say. And then once he gets in, maybe he's more amenable to, you know, reasonable voices. I wouldn't count on that, but he's certainly not an AOC just by temperament. But you do talk about some of the key planks of his energy plan, such as it is. And I assume that involves so-called renewables.
Yeah, so I'll just read. I mean, with these, I should just say, with this website, it just right now links to a public Google Drive with public Google Docs. One of the goals of it is just to give people talking points that they can tweet. So every single thing in here is 280 characters or less. So you can just easily share it, cite it, et cetera. So I'll just read you the top level summary, which is Joe Biden's energy plan calls for outlawing reliable fossil fuel electricity and mandating unreliable solar and wind electricity. This will not stop CO2 emissions from rising, but it will destroy American industry, impoverish American consumers, and jeopardize American security. And then I go on to, I have about, you know, six, seven, eight points, I guess, elaborating on that. But it is, you know, regardless of his own, what's in his heart or whatever, he's part of this anti-fossil fuel movement that has almost a monopoly on the discussion. And it's, if I were to draw an analogy, it would be something like if you had an anti-antibiotics movement and just everyone was only focused on the side effects of antibiotics and nobody talked about the benefits of antibiotics and how hard they are to replace, you would make terrible decisions about antibiotics. And that's what we're doing with fossil fuels. Fossil fuels are, in a sense, more important than antibiotics because they're what enable us to use machine labor instead of manual labor. Energy is machine food, and fossil fuels are by far the most low-cost and scalable form of machine food. And yet, if we don't talk about the benefits of that, if we only look at side effects and we tend to dramatically exaggerate the side effects, we're talking about banning something that everything depends on. And by everything, I mean agriculture, manufacturing, certainly medicine. I mean, we're talking right now about making and manufacturing a vaccine for 7 billion people. How does that happen without low-cost, reliable, scalable electricity? So it's such a dangerous direction. And too many people are ignorant. Just one quick point I make in one of my sets of talking points, I think it's in the fracking one, which is that, you know, Obama ran on ending the tyranny of oil. He gave this speech in 2007. But when he got in office, there was enough sense of people to tell him, hey, you know, you can't really do that because oil is really fundamental to everything. And so by the end of his term or after his term, he took credit for the shale revolution and fracking. So we can hope that Biden gets that kind of wisdom, but there's such an overwhelming anti-fossil fuel sentiment that somebody as kind of empty as Biden is just could easily do, you know, take us off a cliff.
What about the response you hear these days that you didn't hear in the past from people who support wind and solar power? In the past, they really were kind of quieted down when you would say, you can't possibly supply the amount of energy we need and at a cost that's reasonable as compared to what you can get from fossil fuels. These days, they feel like they have a comeback to that. Increasingly, you hear people saying that actually these renewables are increasingly becoming more cost effective and more efficient in energy production. Is there anything to that?
There's something to that in the sense that let's distinguish between a substitute and a supplement and a waste. So a substitute would mean you can do what fossil fuels can do. So, and that includes, by the way, transportation, including heavy-duty things like airplanes and cargo ships and large agricultural equipment. And there's no clue of how to do that with any form of electricity, let alone solar and wind. So you need to keep that in mind too. And it's important that people don't think about that. They just talk about electricity because that's the most plausible. But you could even ask with electricity, as long as you recognize that's not the only source, that can you produce reliable electricity at low cost? Can you substitute for what fossil fuels do, which is they're providing the vast majority on demand? And in practice, what happens is solar and wind are used as an unreliable supplement. So fossil fuels or nuclear or hydro are expected to provide energy, electricity in the form of electricity all the time. And then what happens is, and it's a really perverse policy, whenever the wind blows, you cycle down, say, the natural gas. And when the wind stops blowing, you cycle it up. And so it's basically you're running your whole grid like stop and go traffic, and it's super inefficient. It wears the machines out, but you're never substituting for it. It's a supplement, but it's a very wasteful supplement. And this is why whenever you add these, what I call unreliables, you have to pay for all the reliable energy infrastructure and the unreliable energy infrastructure, and it ends up being wasteful. And that's why the more of this stuff gets used, the more expensive electricity is. And you take a place like Germany, which is about 33% electricity from solar and wind, they're not relying on it at all. It's still just a supplement, but it's a supplement that makes their electricity three times more expensive than ours is.
Talk about what, I don't know if this is your term or not, energy poverty, where people have to pay more than probably they ought to, where for energy, and energy becomes just the acquisition of energy for their own use becomes a hardship.
Sure. So I'll just actually have it in front of me. So I'll just read the first talking point, which is tens of millions of Americans live in energy poverty, meaning they experience hardship paying for their basic energy needs. 25 million U.S. households say they've gone without food or medicine to pay for energy. 12 million say they've kept their homes at an unsafe temperature. So you just think about that. And one of the points that I make, it's actually the second point, is which that energy poverty should have decreased because our number one form of electricity that we're using and heating fuel is natural gas. And I think people know in general, the price of natural gas has plummeted. And so if that's most of your fuel, then you would expect your costs to go down. But no, energy costs, especially electricity costs, have gone up significantly. Why? It's because we've added so much of this wasteful, unreliable solar and wind infrastructure to the grid. So when you hear that, you hear like solar and wind are cheap, it's always what I call partial cost accounting. They're not looking at the full cost of it, including the cost of the reliable infrastructure to support it and the cost of the inefficiency of the stop and go traffic. They're just looking at, say, oh, let's look at the solar panels and the wind turbines. They often don't even look at all these new transmission lines you have to build. So it's really a form of energy accounting fraud. But if you get the logic that if you have unreliables, you still need the reliables, then you'll get why, oh yeah, this stuff, it's not replacing costs on the grid, it's just adding costs to the grid.
Well, that brings to mind what you have on the talking points on the wind production tax credit, which I didn't know about, but I guess in the back of my mind, I assumed there probably was such a thing. What I found particularly interesting about this is this extremely revealing quotation from Warren Buffett. And you say, the only reason utilities buy unnecessary, wasteful wind turbines is government policies that force them to do so or reward them to do so. And here's Warren Buffett. We get a tax credit if we build a lot of wind farms. That's the only reason to build them. That's pretty perverse.
Yeah, and even the tax credit, which I talk about in these talking points, the wind production tax credit, that's only one of a set of incentives. If you just think about, it really doesn't make a whole lot of sense to use unreliables to really be weather dependent, because again, you have to still have you basically have to have all the reliable energy infrastructure you would need to power the grid on its own. And then you got to build all this other stuff, and it takes up huge amounts of space and it's far away. So you got to build all these transmission lines, and then you have to adjust everything all the time and you wear it. So it's just a total mess. So the only reason this is happening is this all kinds of political manipulations. And that's Warren Buffett tends to be honest about certain types of things. He doesn't go out of his way to expose them, but yeah, so they're explaining, yeah, we're getting a bunch of money if we build this unreliable stuff.
Now, you, of course, are the author of The Moral Case for Fossil Fuels, and we all know where you stand on that question. And you recently, just a minute ago, you made an analogy with antibiotics. And you said if we're going to have a debate on that and we were going to focus entirely on the side effects and not on the great benefits of these things, we'd obviously make really bad, destructive decisions. So I want to carry that analogy through and ask you, Alex Epstein, what do you think are the negative side effects of fossil fuels that are undesirable, that even you would say are undesirable?
So the main point, which is what you made, is the method point. And I would say with each one, you have to investigate. So if you want to know my views on why I'm not concerned about CO2 emissions, we can talk about that, or they're summarized in some of the talking points. But I mean, I think the side effects that are undesirable are definitely, I think the number one is air pollution in poorer countries. So if you look at smog in China or in India, and it's not to say that isn't preventable. I think it is preventable through best practices, but to a certain extent, if you're a really poor country and sometimes the pollution control systems cost money, then it won't be worth it. So it'll be worth it to do better than China. And China obviously doesn't respect, or at least obviously to us, does not respect individual rights. So there are all sorts of issues there. But I'd say air pollution is the number one thing that is an issue, because, and the reason it's an issue is because coal is so valuable and nothing comes close to coal in terms of low-cost, reliable electricity that can be used anywhere. That's why it's so dominant in the developing world. But if you don't have the right pollution control, then it does have an undesirable side effect. It's nowhere near the benefit, which is why you see the life expectancy in these places, even when they have a lot of coal pollution, go to up 7, 10 years. And that's totally driven by fossil-fueled machines, like machines that allow you to become a manufacturing powerhouse and industrialize, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, that is the air pollution, I would say, is the biggest one. But fortunately, we have really good ways of dealing with that. I mean, with coal, you can burn coal really cleanly. And we do that for the most part in the US. Of course, you can also use natural gas, which is naturally more clean burning, where that makes economic sense. But there are a lot of places in the world where it doesn't make economic sense to use natural gas, whereas coal is super easy to use anywhere because there's a ton of it and it's really easy to transport.
Everybody, let's take a quick break to thank our unbelievable sponsor, Skillshare. I love Skillshare. My daughters love Skillshare. It's an online learning community with thousands of inspiring classes for creative and curious people. Most classes are under 60 minutes with short lessons to fit any schedule, and the topics are incredibly varied. Everything from photography to graphic design, creative writing and animation, fine art, film and video, marketing, entrepreneurship, web development, and a lot more. On this show, you've heard my daughters talk about how Skillshare has benefited them in their creative pursuits, and I've benefited as well. I'm at a point in my life where I want to work smartly so as to maximize my leisure time. So I very much appreciated Thomas Frank's class, Productivity Masterclass, Create a Custom System That Works. Explore your creativity at Skillshare.com/woods and get 2 free months of premium membership. That's access to thousands and thousands of classes on almost everything under the sun. Head over to Skillshare.com/woods to grab your 2 free months of premium membership. That's Skillshare.com/woods. Let's get over now to climate, because that's really where a lot of the discussion of energy ultimately winds up, particularly these days. And they've kind of stacked the deck so that if you are even skeptical of whether draconian measures are truly necessary, that alone makes you some kind of a crank. You're outside the mainstream. Haven't you heard about 97% of scientists, blah, blah, blah. It's almost impossible to have a conversation because you have to spend so much time tearing down these preconceptions everybody has, these walls they've built up that prevent their own ears from hearing what you're saying. That's the frustrating part of this, it seems to me. Just even to start the conversation, right off the bat, you're assumed to be some backward idiot who doesn't understand science.
Yeah, so to talk about that point, and then I'll give some suggestions on how to deal with it. What you have is, in philosophy, is called an equivocation, which is the same term is used to mean a bunch of different things, usually to manipulate people. So the term climate change and agreeing with climate change, sometimes that means that CO2 emissions cause, you know, some of the 1 degree warming that's occurred in the last 170 years. So sometimes it means that, which is a very mild thing. Sometimes it means it's going to cause dramatic warming in the future. And sometimes it means it's going to cause such dramatic warming in the future that we need to get rid of fossil fuels, even though that would end billions of lives prematurely. And what happens with these 97% type things is they take the first one, which is fossil fuels contribute to some of the warming, and then they equate that with we have to outlaw fossil fuels. So one shorthand way of thinking of this is that climate change, like believing in quote climate change, which is a pretty vague term, but believing in man-made climate influence, which is a little more precise, that's not the same as believing in man-made climate catastrophe, let alone believing in a Green New Deal, which is the most irrational way to deal with anything because it's also anti-nuclear and largely anti-hydro. And so then that it's important just to get at, you want to separate in people's mind, like believing that fossil fuels have some impact with fossil fuels have a catastrophic impact. And so in my talking points on the so-called climate crisis, which I have some brief ones up and within the next week, I'm going to have like 50 of them up. And I think then people will really see. But one of the points that I find very powerful, and this is point one, is that when you hear scary claims about a climate crisis, keep in mind that climate catastrophists have been claiming climate crisis for 40 years. For example, Obama science advisor John Holdren predicted in the 1980s that we'd have up to 1 billion climate deaths today. And the second point is, after 40 years of climate crisis predictions by climate catastrophists, human beings are safer than ever from climate. The climate death rate has decreased by 98%. Over the last century. And I go into it more, but the basic thing for people to get is, yeah, we have some influence on the climate conditions, but the real influence that we have is our adaptability is so much greater because we have low-cost machine power that we can use to build a sturdy and durable civilization. And if we care about safety from climate, it matters a lot more how adaptable you are than exactly what's happening in the climate.
Gotcha. Okay. So the way I've thought about it as somebody who's not a specialist in this, but, you know, is a reasonably informed layman, is that most of what the U.S. has proposed to do, or people, you know, climate change people in the U.S. have proposed, would have essentially no noticeable effect if only the U.S. does it. And in fact, that is the likely outcome, that China's not going to hobble itself with these restrictions, and neither is India. So all we're doing is shooting ourselves in the foot for basically no gain whatsoever. Meanwhile, the question becomes, is this problem of climate change, is it something that we can learn to adapt to and live with in some way, or is it absolutely catastrophic to the point where civilization becomes impossible? And if it's the first one, we should direct our energies to that while at the same time continuing to have a free and open economy that progresses, that creates more wealth, that makes even still cleaner energy options possible. And, you know, perhaps we can mitigate some of the effects that way as well. That's been my outlook the whole time. Is there anything wrong with that? Is that basically your view?
Yeah, I mean, I add to that the point that I was just making, which is this point about climate adaptation, or I'll sometimes call it climate mastery, because we have to recognize that we've been putting more CO2 in the atmosphere for the last 170 years, and particularly the last, let's say, 70 years. And we have data about how safe is the climate. And as I mentioned, the death rate from climate, which means storms, floods, extreme heat, extreme cold, drought, all those things, that's down by 98% in the last century when you really start to have measurements. If you just think about that, that means you're 1/50th as likely to die from a climate-related cause. And so if people don't recognize that actually the livability of the climate is improving, and there's not curiosity about why that is when it's supposedly getting worse, then they're not going to understand it. So it's really, we've been taught to think that nature gives us a perfect climate, or it gives us a naturally safe climate that we make dangerous. And actually it gave us a naturally dangerous climate that we've made really safe, largely using machine power powered by fossil fuels. And so it's assumed that we have this big problem versus this area of life is improving. But you really have to look at the full benefits of fossil fuels, and then really look at, is there really a significant side effect that's hurting human life? And I think a lot of what's going on is people think that if we're changing the climate at all, that's immoral and it must be taking us to some sort of hell. And I think that's a religious type of assumption, whereas I think changing the climate could be good, bad, neutral. And we just have to look at how significant is that and how significant is our ability to adapt. And it turns out it's not that significant, and our ability to adapt is massive as long as we're allowed to use fossil fuels.
So describe then what you hope to do with energytalkingpoints.com, which you continue to expand. I noticed that not all the material was added at the same time, so it's a work in progress. Presumably, it's for the general public, but also we hope people, let's say people running for office, who might be able to use some intelligent points.
Yeah, it's actually initially conceived of, and then the overall goal is to influence the energy conversation this election year, because it's such a vital year in so many ways. But there's so many energy policies on the line, and I think that the discussion about them is the same thing I discussed before. It's so obsessed with an exaggerating of the side effects of fossil fuels and not talking about the benefits. And people are, I mean, they're considering policies that would literally shorten the lives of billions of people if enacted globally, and if enacted in the U.S., to your earlier point, would just be a national suicide for us, which is the last thing that we need for so many reasons in today's world. So I'm hoping to influence the discussion, and it's particularly designed for candidates, because I know that candidates have been immersed in the regular system. They're overwhelmed by these things. They can't study these issues full time. So what I wanted to do is create talking points that I know from experience are really powerful. And also they're very brief, so you can use them. And they also are backed up by really good references. So each one of these has, you know, an explanation, it has facts, but then it has the references, so that you're not going to say something and then you're going to get embarrassed later. And I should just say, I would hope that people listening to this, that you use it yourself, but particularly if you know anyone running for office, please share this with them, and feel free to have them contact me directly at alex@alexepstein.com, because in some cases where I have the bandwidth, I can help them customize it to their own purposes free of charge.
One last thing before we go. Obviously, you look at these questions much differently from how most people, let's say, who would consider themselves to be opinion molders do. And what I want to know is, do you attribute that to you're all looking at the same facts, but you come at it from a radically different philosophical perspective, or you're bringing facts to bear that they're leaving out, or a combination of both?
This is a great question. And I'm working on the second version of Moral Case for Fossil Fuels, and I emphasize this point a lot. So I would say it's a combination of both, but the primary is definitely the philosophy, or what I would call the framework. And just to address it very briefly, it comes down to your philosophy or your starting point about impact. So I think what's going on is we're taught to believe two things about human impact on nature. One is that it's immoral, and two is that because the planet is perfect before we impact it, people think of impact as inevitably self-destructive. So they think that if you take climate, they think that, well, if we increase the amount of CO2 from 0.03% of the atmosphere to 0.04% of the atmosphere, first and foremost, that's wrong. We have no right to do that. We shouldn't be changing things. We shouldn't be playing God, et cetera. And then, consistent with thinking it's wrong, they think, oh, well, if it's wrong, we must be punished for it. And there's this mythology of, oh, the ecosystem is this delicate balance. And if you throw it out of balance by impacting things, it's going to bite us in the ass, et cetera. And you just look at human history and you see, no, wait a second. There was no delicate balance. There was no delicate anything. There was just a massively deficient and dangerous planet. And we had to dramatically transform it through productive ability to make it abundant and safe. And then that's powered by fossil fuel machines. And so if you look at the overall livability of the planet, it demands massive impact. And the core of our ability to impact it is the machine power that only fossil fuels make possible. But I don't have this bias against human impact. I have a bias, if you could call it that, toward human flourishing. So when I look at human impact, I think, oh, this is overall a really good thing. We don't want to do it unintelligently, but we really need to impact the Earth a lot. And I certainly don't have this expectation I call the perfect planet premise, that the unimpacted planet is perfect and all we can do is ruin it. And so because I have a totally different moral view about impact, and because I don't have this pseudoscientific mystical view that impact must send us to hell, then I can just look at fossil fuels and say, oh, wow, this is like antibiotics or vaccines, but actually way better because it's so beneficial in so many ways. And also it has this amazing quality where, because fossil fuels make us productive and they free up a lot of time, they actually give us the ability to deal with its negative consequences. So if they create any negative climate consequences, they give us so much ability and so much time that we can overwhelm those. And that's one reason why climate is 50 times safer than it was 100 years ago.
I have a feeling, just a gut instinct, that one of the things that got you into this whole subject matter was a frustration with existing defenders of, let's say, industrial capitalism, because they were coming at it from, they were arguing with one hand tied behind their backs because they more or less accepted at least half the philosophy of the other side. And you want to just come over and blow the lid off the whole thing and show, if you're going to really be in opposition, be in opposition. Are my instincts sound on this?
Yes. Well, once again, this is a very exact idea that you have. But it relates to, I make this point, fossil fuels don't take a safe climate and make it dangerous. They take a dangerous climate and make it safe. You can take even a less controversial example, like how much have fossil fuels helped us with clean water? Water isn't naturally clean. The world doesn't give us Evian and Perrier all the time. And in fact, you know, water is naturally dirty and it's naturally inaccessible for most people. What do fossil fuels do? They give us the machine power to purify the naturally dirty water, and they give us the machine power to pump the naturally unavailable water from where it is to where we need it. And what's fascinating about this point about fossil fuels making the water cleaner is I don't remember anyone ever publicly saying this before I started doing it. I'm sure somebody did, but certainly nobody in the industry. And I've actually gotten some of them to do it. And it's because they have, I call it this anti-impact framework, where they think impact is immoral and inevitably self-destructive. And so it doesn't even occur to them that fossil fuels' impacts on the world could actually be making our environment better. And it's such a cool realization to have. But it's no accident I even got that realization primarily from this guy, Ankar Gatte, I worked with when I was at the Ayn Rand Institute. He's the one who really even, and we're all both coming from objectivist philosophy, but he's more sophisticated than I was. I mean, he still is in many ways. But he just said, hey, wait a second, you know, we're talking about environment. Let's talk about all the ways in which industry improves environment. And I realized, yeah, that's such a good point. You can only have that if you have this, what I call human flourishing framework, where you think that the goal is human flourishing and that intelligent impact is good and it helps us improve an imperfect planet. Then it's just everything makes sense. And you just see, oh my gosh, fossil fuels are, it's almost obvious once you have the human framework.
Well, the resource that we've been talking about is energytalkingpoints.com. It's great, by the way, at this late stage in 2020 to be able to get a .com, you know, domain name that's still pretty good. Energytalkingpoints.com.
I know,
really
I didn't have
good.
To pay anything extra for it either. It just shows you how little interest there is in the
Yeah,
stuff.
Exactly. I know, because normally if you get something that's that good, it's going to cost you $2,000 at least or something.
No, it's like 10 bucks.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. All right, so I'll also link to that for anybody, you know, for whatever reason you don't remember it, at this is episode 1712, so tomwoods.com/1712. We'll link to that, and I'll also link to Alex's book, a very important book, The Moral Case for Fossil Fuels, and we'll have a bunch of Alex Epstein things there, a whole smorgasbord of Alex Epstein for you at tomwoods.com/1712. Well, thanks again, Alex, for your important work and for your time today.
Awesome. Thanks so much for having me.
All right, everybody, before I let you go, a bit of good news. I think it's good news. The talk I gave at the Mises Institute last month called The Fact-Free Lockdown Hysteria has now had over 330,000 views on YouTube and probably more by the time you hear this. That's pretty darn good news. So thanks for watching that video, if you have, and for picking up my free ebook, Your Facebook Friends Are Wrong About the Lockdown, over at wrongaboutlockdown.com. I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.